that song, it won't be very long. I never again will hear that song that I won't think about a Wednesday night several years ago that we were having our Wednesday night singing and prayer meeting. And a young man wandered in off the street that obviously had enjoyed a little too much of fermented beverage that day. And he sat on the back row. And we sang that song, "It Won't Be Very Long." And just as we finished singing the song, from the back row I heard this voice. And the slurred speech, "Well, how long's it gonna be?" I'll always remember that, Leon, every time we sing that song. We're glad you're here. We've been talking in these lessons about things that people have misconceptions about churches of Christ. We've been talking about myths, misconceptions, and misinformation. And one of the big misconceptions people have about churches of Christ is the kind of music that we have in our worship. I've often had people that would talk to me and they'd say, "Oh yes, I know about churches of Christ. Y'all are the ones that don't have music." And yet, my friends, that is absolutely an incorrect statement. We have music in our worship. We believe in music in our worship. But we do not have instrumental music in our worship. When you study music, you learn that there are actually only two types of music. You have on the one hand vocal music, and you have on the other hand instrumental music. God has, in His Word, specified vocal music, but not instrumental music. And there'll be more about that later on this morning. But this music thing, that's something that most people notice immediately when they walk into our assembly for the very first time. In fact, for most folks to walk into our assembly for the very first time, it's something to them of a religious culture shock. It's nothing particularly weird. It's just the fact that it's not the kind of music that most folks are accustomed to. In fact, if you get right down to it, most worship services today in Christian culture are filled with sounds that we don't have. Sounds that are conspicuously absent in our worship. You don't hear the sounds of an organ or a piano. You don't hear drums or guitars or keyboards or harps or bells or horns or any other instruments of any kind. They are nowhere to be heard. The musical sound that fills our services, the musical sounds that is heard by first-time guests in our worship, is the sound of voices. Just voices. Singing praises to God. Our music is 100% vocal. It is a cappella. And to be very clear, to be quite frank, most people who encounter this for the very first time find it to be somewhat strange. And yet, even though this kind of musical praise is strange in our culture today, Would you believe that it has been the practice of most churches since the very beginning of Christianity? And a lot of people find that a bit hard to swallow. All right. Let's start with the word a cappella. The word a cappella, today we know that means singing without musical accompaniment. But the word a cappella is actually an Italian word. And it literally means in the chapel style, or as in the chapel. So when someone says they are going to sing a cappella, they are saying they are going to sing like in the chapel. I've done some research on this subject. So far as I have been able to determine, the very first organ that was ever introduced into the worship of any body of people claiming to be Christians occurred 670 years after Christ. And it was introduced by Pope Vitellian I. And when Pope Vitellian I introduced it, it threatened division within the Catholic Church and was taken out to preserve the unity of the church. Sometime later, in the 800s, you will find a few isolated instances of the use of the organ among groups who called themselves Christians. But vocal-only praise remained the norm until the 1300s. A man by the name of Joseph Bingham was an English scholar. He was an ecclesiastical historian of the 18th century. Bingham wrote a 10-volume history of the Christian church. It's actually entitled The Antiquities of the Christian Church. Here is what Bingham writes, volume 1, page 315. Music in churches is as ancient as the apostles, but instrumental music not so. For it is now generally agreed among learned men that the use of organs came into the church since the time of Thomas Aquinas in 1250. Now I want you to let that soak in. I want you to let it soak in really good. By the time that Thomas Aquinas came along, the church had been worshiping for 1,200 years. And one of the few practices that had remained remarkably constant over that period was what? Vocal-only praise. But all of that was about to change. The instrument started showing up in worship with increasing regularity in the early 1300s. Historians also report that by the early 1500s, organs had become a fixture in almost every important church building on the continent of Europe. Now remember, all of this was happening in the Roman Catholic Church. At that time, Catholicism in most of Western Europe was the only game in town. Well, organs had not been a fixture very long in Catholic worship. When those pesky reformers like Martin Luther and others showed up, and they had their own radical idea about reform. And with those pesky reformers, things were about to change again. Remember, we talked about the Reformation movement. If you're going to have a reformation, the first thing you need is something to reform, right? Well, just as having something to reform is important, something to reform it to is also important. The reformers, such as Martin Luther, what did they want to reform? They wanted to reform the Roman Catholic Church. And the something they wanted to reform it to was the church as it was found on the pages of the New Testament. The Reformation movement was largely a movement to actually recover Bible doctrine. The objective was to move things closer to the simplicity and purity of New Testament times. Do you remember from our study last Lord's Day? The name of a man called Huldrych Zwingli. You remember that? This means yes, this means no. You remember the name of a man called Huldrych Zwingli? Stay with me. Don't let me lose you. Hold that thought. Timothy George is the former dean of the Beeson Divinity School, which is a part of Samford University. Timothy George wrote a book entitled Theology of the Reformers. This is a quote from page 131 of that work. The Catholic authorities were shocked at the rigor with which Zwingli pursued his reforms. In 1527, the organ at the Great Minster was dismantled and removed. Despite the fact that Zwingli was an accomplished musician who had mastered a number of instruments. Now it says the organ at the Great Minster was removed. The Great Minster was the name of the church in Zurich that was the home base of the reforming work of Huldrych Zwingli. And the organ there was dismantled. Even though Zwingli was an accomplished musician, even though Zwingli could play numerous instruments, they dismantled the organ so it would no longer be used in worship. That was a part of Zwingli's reforms. And there are numerous other historical perspectives of the reformers that we could cite this morning. But hopefully you'll appreciate the fact that in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into all the historical perspectives that are available. The Puritans in America and England were opposed to the use of instruments in worship. But in the 1700s, the conviction of vocal-only music began to erode. And by the late 1800s, vocal-only praise in worship was an endangered species in American church life. And yet, among prominent names in the 1800s, the use of instrumental music in worship was still opposed. Adam Clark has to rank as one of the most illustrious Bible commentators ever known to the world. Adam Clark lived in the 1800s. Adam Clark was a Bible scholar. In almost every preacher's library, you will find a set of Clark's commentaries. And most of the time, Clark's commentaries are well-worn and well-used. Adam Clark was a Methodist. And Adam Clark was a contemporary of John Wesley. And concerning the use of the organ in worship, here is what Adam Clark has to say. Adam Clark writes, I am an old man and an old minister, and I here declare that I have never known them, mechanical instruments, productive of any good in the worship of God. And I have reason to believe they were productive of much evil. Music as a science I esteem and admire. But instruments of music in the house of God I abominate and I abhor. This is the abuse of music. And I here register my protest against all such corruption in the worship of the infinite Spirit who requires His followers to worship Him in spirit and in truth. That's what Adam Clark has to say. In that same commentary, in Clark's commentary, Clark, who was a contemporary of John Wesley, quoting John Wesley, Clark writes, "I have no objection to the organ in our chapels, provided it is neither seen nor heard." Does the name Charles Spurgeon ring a bell? For 38 years, Spurgeon filled the pulpit of the Metropolitan Baptist Tabernacle in London, England. During that 38 years, the sound of the organ was never heard in the building where Charles Spurgeon preached. Here is what Spurgeon has to say and how he felt about instrumental music or instruments of music in worship. He writes, "David appears to have had a peculiarly tender remembrance of the singing of the pilgrims. And assuredly, it is the most delightful part of worship and that which comes nearest to the adoration of heaven. What a degradation to supplant the intelligent song of the whole congregation by the theatrical prettiness of a quartet, the refined niceties of a choir, or the blowing off of wind from inanimate bellows and pipes. We might as well pray by machinery as praise by it." That's in Spurgeon's commentary, Treasury of David, Volume 1, page 272, and those are his comments on the 42nd Psalm. That book is in my library if you want to read it. All of this is a snapshot, but it's not an exhaustive discussion by any means of the historical context of the instrument. But I'm dealing with a finite amount of time, aren't I? So let's move on to another aspect of the discussion of instrumental music in the worship of God. There are arguments that people make in favor of instrumental music. It is said that music is a natural talent, like speaking and singing, and therefore as a natural talent it should be dedicated to God. Listen to what the Scriptures say in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 19. In that passage, Paul would write, "Speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord." And then he writes in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 16, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." Did you notice something about those two passages of Scripture? In those passages, the Bible specifies speaking and singing, but nowhere does it specify instruments of music. Well, this idea that it's a natural talent, what does this natural talent argument in favor of instrumental music mean if you submit it to the test of logic? In logic, you have a major premise, a minor premise, and then that leads you to a conclusion. So if you say that instrumental music is a natural talent, and you use the argument and put it to the test of logic, anything that is natural is approved for worship. That would be your major premise. Instrumental music is a natural talent. That would be your minor premise. Therefore, instrumental music is approved for worship. And that would be your conclusion. Do you really want to go there? Do you really, and do we really want to accept the major premise that anything that is natural is approved for worship? I'm not going to go into that, but you just let your mind wander on that for a while and ponder that for a while. Anything natural is approved for worship. That has to be your major premise. Then your minor premise is you start coming up with things that are natural. And then you draw your conclusion that that is therefore approved for worship. Well, it said, well, you can have instrumental music in the home. Why can't we have instrumental music in the church? If you remember our study of Corinthians a few years ago, or if you've studied the book of Corinthians, you'll remember the church at Corinth was condemned for making a church dinner out of the Lord's Supper. There are many things, beloved, that are morally right, and at the same time, they're religiously wrong. There are many things that we do in the home that are morally right, and at the same time, it's religiously wrong. It's morally right to bathe. And you believe that, especially if you've been around somebody that doesn't do it. It's morally right to bathe, but it's not morally right, and it's wrong to bathe as an act of worship. There's a lot of things we do at home that are morally right, but they're not an act of worship. Well, they say, well, you have instrumental music in heaven. If you can have instrumental music in heaven, why can't you have it in the church? Who told you there are instrumental music in heaven? Who told you there were instruments of music there? Sometimes folks say, well, if God has instruments in heaven, that's His business. But He didn't put it in the church, so we have no right to do that. Well, that would be true, but that misses the mark. Here's the question. Are there mechanical instruments of music in heaven? Heaven is the home of the soul. Remember our study of Revelation that we concluded just a few weeks ago. Heaven is the place where the spirits of just men are made perfect. What would a spiritual being do with a material harp? We might as well argue that there's going to be Fords, Chevrolets, Cadillacs, and Lincolns in heaven as to argue that there are going to be mechanical instruments of music. This idea that there are instruments of music in heaven is a totally mistaken idea where people have done violence to the Scriptures in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is a book of symbols. It is a book of signs. The record says, the Bible says, Revelation says in Revelation 1 and verse 1, these things were signified unto John. Signify is a word that comes from the word sign. Signify, signify. If something is signified, it is set forth in a sign. A sign can't be a sign of itself. It's a sign of something else. So therefore, the harp that's mentioned in Revelation has to be a sign of something else. It signifies something else. In Revelation chapter 8 and verse 3, it says that incense was added to the prayers of the saints. Were there actual harps and actual bowls of incense in heaven, or is it a sign of something else? Revelation chapter 14, verses 1 through 3 is an often abused passage of Scripture. And lo, I looked, and a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having the Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And the voice I heard was as the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000, the redeemed of the earth. I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of a great thunder. Didn't say I heard a great thunder. It says as the voice of a great thunder. That represents volume. And the voice I heard was as the voice of many waters. It wasn't the many waters. It was as the voice of many waters. Have you ever stood under a waterfall or near a waterfall and listened to the perfect rhythm of the water coming over that waterfall? The thunder's the volume. The water is the rhythm. And the voice that I heard was as the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And that represents melody. The thunder's the volume, the water's the rhythm, the harpers is the melody. The 144,000 redeemed of earth were gathered around the throne of God and singing a new song in heaven and praising God. And the volume was great and the rhythm was immeasurable and the melody was beautiful. But it doesn't mean there are literal harps in heaven. Okay, well, we'll use instruments of music in the worship because instrumental music was in the Old Testament. So was incense. So was circumcision. And so were animal sacrifices. Some man comes along in some modern church today and he's carrying a censer of incense, and he walks on, and somebody says, what are you doing there? I'm bringing incense to worship God. Oh, no, we can't have incense. Well, David had incense. Well, David may have had incense. But we don't have incense in worship today. And then along comes somebody else walking up the aisle at some progressive church today, and he's got a goat in his hand. What are you doing? I'm bringing an animal sacrifice to offer to God. Oh, we don't do that anymore. Well, David did it. Well, David may have done it under the old law, but we don't do that today. And then along comes a man walking along, strumming on his guitar. What are you doing? I'm bringing my guitar for worship like David had his harp. Come on in with David's harp, brother. Do you see the inconsistency in that? You throw out David's incense, you throw out David's animal sacrifice, but David's harp is okay. Where do you find the rationale for making that distinction? Anywhere in the Scriptures. Do we abandon the New Testament and go back and worship under the law? What did we say in the very beginning of this study? We're seeking to restore New Testament Christianity. And remember in the very first lesson we talked about this radical idea of restoration. Restoring worship after the pattern of the first century. We have numerous examples of singing in the New Testament. In Matthew 26 and verse 30 we have the disciples of Jesus. When they'd sung a hymn they went out into the Mount of Olives. In Acts chapter 16 verse 25 Paul and Silas are in prison and at midnight they prayed and sang praises to God and the prisoners heard them. In Romans 15 and verse 9, Paul writes, "For this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles and sing unto thy name." In 1 Corinthians 14 verse 15, Paul writes, "What is it then? I will pray with the Spirit, I will pray with the understanding, I'll sing with the Spirit, and I'll sing with the understanding also." Remember at the very beginning this morning we said there are only two types of music. There's vocal music and there's instrumental music. God specified vocal music. Go back to those two passages we read in Ephesians 5:19. Speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing. and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 16. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. God specified singing. By the grammatical law of exclusion, when God specifies that He wants singing, that excludes everything else. Let me illustrate it this way. Let's suppose that after services this morning, you decide that you're going to go up the road to Whataburger and have lunch. And you walk up to the counter and the person at the counter says, "May I take your order, please?" "Yes, I'd like a Whataburger with cheese, and I'd like French fries and a chocolate milkshake." And they ring it up. They give you your total. That'll be $74. And you pay it, and you go sit down. And you're sitting there salivating, thinking about your cheeseburger, your Whataburger with cheese, your chocolate milkshake, your French fries. And they bring you a chicken sandwich, onion rings, and a Diet Coke. And you say, "Well, wait a minute, I ordered a Whataburger with cheese and French fries and a chocolate milkshake. This isn't what I ordered." "Well, you didn't tell us not to bring you this." You know what you're going to say? "Could I speak to the manager, please?" But that's the people say that about instrumental music. God specified singing. And people will say today, "Well, God didn't say not to use instruments of music." The only place where that law of exclusion doesn't work is in the realm of religion. If you go into a restaurant and you order, you don't have to go into that restaurant and say and tell them everything on the menu you don't want, do you? When you order in that restaurant, when you tell the person in that restaurant, "I want the chicken fried steak dinner with mashed potatoes," what have you done? You've automatically excluded everything else on that menu, haven't you? Why in the name of common sense do we have so much problem understanding that when God said singing, God automatically excluded every other kind of music? To me, it's quite simple to understand that. And the only reason people today don't understand it is that people today don't want to understand it. Because they don't really want to make Jesus the Lord and Master of their lives. Because you see, when Jesus is Lord and Master of our lives, we're going to want to do things His way. We're going to want to do things the way Jesus tells us to do them. And all we're trying to do is simply seeking to restore first century Christianity to the worship of the 21st century. And part of that work of restoration involves the practices of worship. It involves baptism. It involves salvation. We talked about those two things, if you'll remember, the past two Sundays. The question is Jesus the Lord and Master of your life this morning? Or are there changes that need to be made in your life for Him to be the Lord and Master of your life? If there are things that need to be changed in your life for Jesus to be Lord and Master of your life, and we can help you make those changes, we invite you to come and let us help you do that as together we stand and while we sing.